Give me your arms for the brokenhearted, the ones that are far beyond my reach. Give me your heart for the ones forgotten. Give me your eyes so I can see. Give me your eyes, Lord, give me your eyes so I can see. For everything that I keep missing, give me your love for humanity. Give me your heart for the brokenhearted.
Hi, welcome to Life Matters. This is Mariah Wilde, your host and the founder and executive director of Family Link. I am so excited to be with you tonight. We're going to have an incredible time. I want to tell you, give you some updates. What is going on with Family Link? One, we have an incredible event coming up this Saturday. We're in the middle of training new foster and adoptive families. And with those families, we're also doing a special retreat day. You know, when you're in training to be a foster adoptive parent or mentor, we do really give incredible information, but it all comes together when you get to meet some of our wonderful children. And I've had families tell me, you know, volunteering at a retreat needs to be a requirement for somebody who's becoming licensed with you guys, because it just puts everything in perspective. Yes, you have to tell us that they may be very traumatized and some of their hurts may come out in their behaviors. But when we see that these are real children, teenagers with feelings and thoughts, everything you've said and taught just becomes so much more real. So this Saturday, we will have many families becoming licensed with Family Link in training. And then we're also going to have, about midday, some of our already licensed families will be joining us for their continuing education. And then we also have some families with Family Link who don't necessarily need that specific training, but they're going to come for support, to get to know other families for fun. They will get additional training, and they're all of our families are bringing their children. Not all of our families, but the families that are attending are bringing their children, and I cannot wait to meet some of their kids. So this is where volunteering can come in. You know, we need volunteers who really have a heart for kids, volunteers who say, you know, maybe they're already in the process of becoming licensed with us, but even if they're not, just to say, I want to come and spend Saturday with you guys, holding babies, chasing around little toddlers, playing games with the older kids, talking to the teenagers, doing activities with all of them. You know, you can go overseas to spend time with abused and neglected children, and that's a good thing. My family does it. I don't generally because my ministry is here, but definitely support it. My parents just came back from Croatia. My brother went to Croatia. My sister and brother, actually, and my parents, well, my sister and brother have been to Mozambique, in Asia. So I definitely support overseas missions, but I very much support, hey, if you're not going there, then when you're not there, how about help us with our Family Link children? They are so valuable and precious. They need so much love. And sometimes they need some extra love beyond even what their foster parents can give. Or maybe their foster parents and adoptive parents need additional support. And so today is a day where you can decide, how can I partner with Family Link? Maybe you can be a church connector and have us come and give a presentation at your church. You know, I give a presentation of children waiting to be adopted. Waiting to be adopted for free, free college, free insurance. Isn't that amazing? I bet that you know someone who would really love to adopt but has thought that adoption is so expensive. Well, I have great news. Free adoption, free college, free insurance. Wow! And that's for children of all ages. So you can find out more by checking out our website, familylinkkids.com. I love to hear from our listeners. I'd love to get your feedback. Tell me what's on your mind and by contacting me through there. And I'm excited about this show coming up because we have two incredible counselors who are with us today to share from their experience. You know, they counsel children, they counsel adults. So it doesn't matter whether you're a parent. I guarantee you're a person listening. And so I know that today is going to be really helpful to you. So I'd like to welcome my special guest, Deborah Price and Marshall Lyle, to the show. This is y'all's first time to be on Life Matters, and I really am excited to hear from you and hear your heart. So welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here.
I agree. We appreciate you having us, Mariah.
Absolutely. You know, Marshall, I remember we met years ago, and I don't think I haven't seen or talked to you since. And so I'm excited to kind of delve into not only that you have professional experience, but you also have personal experience as an adoptive parent.
That's right. My wife and I were foster parents some years ago and have adopted two kids since then.
That is so awesome. I don't think there's any experience that's like that. And now, Deborah, let's start off with you. Tell us about your background.
I am a licensed professional counselor and a licensed marriage and family therapist, and do a lot of specializing in working with people who actually have experienced trauma. So I've trained in several different approaches to being able to be helpful with that, as well as just doing relationship counseling at the Center for Relational Care.
And so tell us about the center, because many of our listeners may not know. The Center for Relational Care, what is that about?
The Center for Relational Care is a counseling center here in Austin, Texas, and we have a number of therapists that are available to work with a number of different types of issues, whether those are adult relationship problems or marital problems, premarital work. We have several therapists that work with children and also do some work with families as well, where we actually bring the entire family in and do work with them for resolution of relationship problems.
And so relationship problems, I guess, really can encompass everything from work, as you mentioned, marriage, and children. And so, Marshall, is that where you come in? Do you work many times with the family and oftentimes with children, considering your background?
That's correct. My master's is in family psychology, and so I've primarily worked with kids and families my entire career, from residential treatment centers to pediatric units in medical hospitals to children's homes, and now here at the center. I primarily work with the whole family. That might involve having the child alone in the room at times, but always doing parenting work and with the goal of getting kids and parents in the room together.
You know, I find that, and I understand this completely, as a parent, do many parents come to you and say, this is my child's problem, fix my child, in a sense? And yet, I teach in our training classes, wow, you know, we really have to look at ourselves. If we have a stressed out, challenging child, are we stressed out and challenged parents? Share with us about that.
Absolutely. My job is to make the parents feel so safe and cared for that we can look at anything that might be happening in them that could be accidentally triggering their children. And then once we have that part of the relationship really stabilized, we're looking at the kids and what they're bringing into it, any experiences they've gone through that might need a little extra care. I do a lot of educating with parents on understanding their kids' relational needs, what's happening in the moment, and how to start seeing behaviors as cues to what our kids need from us rather than attacks on us.
Oh, that's good. Well, let's break down what you just said. So what would it look like, the first part, helping the family, the parents, feel really safe so they can delve into maybe some of their own triggers, what's going on within them? What would that look like? Give us some examples.
Well, when a mom or dad first come to meet me, which is a requirement, I don't meet any children until moms and dads have had the chance to meet me, we just try to connect and let me hear their story and let them understand more about me and the Center for Relational Care, how we work. And if there's an agreement in philosophy, some of the safety starts to build there, and we'll set up a treatment plan. If it appears that mom and dad are having some significant hurts in their marriage or in their own individual selves, then I might recommend they work with one of our other counselors while I'll start to build a relationship with their child. And then as the healing starts to happen individually, we move it to a more corporate experience. for other parents come in, and they may not be at a place where they're needing their own counselor. And so I take on a role of consult with them, meeting with them regularly, and preparing them for the work that we might be doing in the room with their kid.
Okay, and so you meet with the child, and then you also meet with the parents. What are some things, if there's a family listening, and they think, well, how would this relate to me? So can you give us some, just give us some tips along the way. So we have, and why don't you go ahead and maybe give us a scenario of why a family would even come to see you at Relational Care, and then let's walk through resolving some of those issues. I mean, you can use a similar situation. I know you've seen so many situations, but it helps me to understand, and I know it helps our listeners, if you can give us a picture. So give us a picture of who mom and dad are, what their struggles are, and what the children are, and let's see if we can walk through the how to help that family. And I know there's going to be families that are listening that may really find some similarities and that they can get some help with us even in this time together.
Absolutely. A common issue these days is fear in children. And so a mom and a dad will show up in my office and themselves be pretty nervous, you know, wondering what the process is going to be like, and am I going to be judging their parenting and criticizing them? And so the first part of my heart is just wanting to reassure them that we are here to work together, and I have nothing but compassion for how hard it is to be a parent.
Mm.
And so we will process, you know, whatever hardships are going on, what concerns they have for their kiddo. And so if it's a fear-based issue, I'll help them understand from our relational care perspective where that might be coming from, what it might look like, what might be happening in the parent part of the relationship that's maintaining or triggering that, and we'll start to slowly develop a treatment plan together. After that, I usually meet with the kids for just a few times to get a sense of who they are and get my own assessment information. And then I come back together with mom and dad at that point to do a more thorough planning session to look at how we're going to meet the needs in the room, how I'm going to be able to involve them, and what the expectations are in the room, as well as some things that they can be doing at home, some new additions to routine or some new consistencies that might be helpful, to even how to interact with teachers or Sunday school teachers to help other people in the kids' lives become a more active part of treating what the struggle is.
Oh, that sounds great. So when we come back from a break, I want to hear, give us some, what does fear oftentimes look like in children, and what are some of those techniques and ideas that you give to these parents? Because I know we have many parents listening that may be struggling with this. We definitely have foster parents listening who have children, and then they're, unfortunately, their fear is not fiction-based. They have a reason to have great fear. And so let's just take bedtime as an example. If a child is screaming and crying and doesn't want to be in the room alone, what are some things that you would recommend? So we'll come back from a break. We want to hear from you too, Deborah, when we come back. Y'all are listening to Life Matters. Check us out and donate online at familylinkkids.com. Friend me on Facebook for updates. I update when we place a child, or sometimes I'll say, we're working on the sibling group right now. And so I like to keep our Facebook friends updated. So friend me on Facebook, Mariah Wilde, Family Link, and we will be right back.
Give me your eyes for just 1 second. Give me your eyes so I can see everything that I keep missing. Give me your love for humanity. Give me your arms for the brokenhearted, the ones that are far beyond my reach. Give me your heart for the ones forgotten. Give me your eyes so I can see.
Welcome back to Life Matters. This is Mariah Wilde, and I'm so excited to have Marshall Lyle and Deborah Price on with us, counselors from the Center for Relational Care. And so we were just talking about children. One of the common themes you're seeing is children having great fear. And I know that oftentimes for us at Family Link, it's children having a very hard time going to bed, and then also it can be taking a bath. So share with us, if you're a foster parent listening or a biological parent who's having some of those particular struggles, what are some common, And I know it depends if they were to come visit with you and give you some of their more specifics. But what are some ideas that you would want to give our listeners right now about how to help their children?
Right. Well, Mariah, even the two examples that you used, I can tell you're familiar with. Those are very common in my office as well. And it seems like kids, when they forced to slow down at times such as bath or bedtime, can no longer ignore the thoughts that they've been distracted from all day. And so it doesn't seem that they're not fearing during the day. It's more a means of being able to ignore the fear up until a point where there are no distractions. And then the experience of the fear is so great. So it becomes really important for mom and dad to understand that while sometimes it might feel manipulative because of the timing of the experience of the fear, that it's not necessarily manipulative, that sometimes that's just the first time kids have really got in touch with that feeling all day long.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, and so then what could we do about that?
And it seems like we need to really work, and even in the Christian community, on being a little more educated about validating the hurt underneath fear. It doesn't mean that we want to reinforce fear, but when kids are experiencing something that out of control, they desperately need to be comforted first and foremost. They need a mom and dad who understand what that feels like, how chaotic it feels in their minds, and how sad a mom or dad feels for that scared heart. After the comfort, we really kind of see their hearts open up, and we can be able to speak a little more sensitive truth into the fear. But we just don't want to lead with rational thought. We don't want to try and convince them that what they're feeling is wrong or that what they're thinking is illogical, because we can all know that fear is illogical. They're just more receptive to the teachable moments after their hearts have been comforted.
So what would that look like? So we have a child screaming in bed. Let's just make this child 7, because I think people might expect that, oh, well, it's 2 or 3. But let's make it let's just say a 7-year-old child. I mean, it could be a 10 or 12-year-old child, but we'll just say 7. And so this child is screaming, I don't want to go to bed. No, no, no. So what does it look like?
Absolutely. It could vary based on each kid's individual heart, but it's going to look like taking their hand, really looking into their eyes, using a soft, still voice, and saying words like, I am so sad that you're scared. It really hurts my heart to see how hard it is right now for you. And really just speaking that comfort that comes from the Lord when we're hurt out directly over our children.
And so at that point, what if they continue screaming and thrashing?
At that point, we need to look at introducing some routines, really understanding that security is often the need of the moment. And so if we can start predicting the times when the fear is going to show up, such as bath time or bedtime, then we can introduce a new routine before we hit that moment. That maybe the kids even can be a part of creating. It might be a special song that starts playing while the bath water is running every night. It might be a routine of, this is how we lay out our pajamas, and this is when we say our prayers, and this is when we read our story, and letting the kids know, we anticipate with you the scary time is coming, and we're doing something new and different so that perhaps you can experience that moment differently.
So would you say that's a good idea. Would you say with some of the older children, it would be helpful to say, I see that you're having such a hard time at night. What if we together came up with a plan that would help you to feel more safe and secure? Because sleep is when our body heals. Maybe this is, but you mentioned something that's really important. When a child is upset, that's not a teaching moment. So we're not talking about when they're upset. We're talking about during the day when they're happy, just had lunch, and they're just playing around. Say, hey, I want to talk to you. So what would that look like? So if they're talking to the child and having the child I'm thinking that a child would be fantastic for them to say, have some input. Yes, I would like to hear this song when I'm going to sleep, and I would like to be able to do this, this, and this. And having them kind of help create the system and the routine with the parent will help give them some control.
Absolutely, and I think that what you said is important, that we tried to have those discussions in the happy moments, in the peaceful moments, you know, asking the kids, wonder if you would like to choose what book we're going to read for the next couple of weeks, and it might become an outing that we go to the library together to pick that up. Even asking the kids during those times, wonder what words you like to hear when I pray for you at night. What makes your heart feel calm and like I understand you? And then there's this wonderful Bible that I've been reading with my kids. It's called the Storybook Bible, the Jesus Storybook Bible. And it takes the stories of Scripture and makes them one continuous story about who Jesus is and the heart of God. And that seems to be something that a lot of kids hear as secure and reassuring. And so it might even be introducing something specific like that into the routine.
Oh, I think that sounds wonderful. I love that wording. So say it again. If I had a pen, I would have written it down. Good thing I can listen to this later. I'm wondering if, you said it twice. What, I'm wondering if, give us a couple more, some words so the parents can really add this to their vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can, you know, talking to your children, I'm wondering if you can help me choose some things that will help you feel safe and secure at nighttime. I'm wondering if you would like to be in charge of the book we read. I'm wondering if you have words that you like for me to pray that make your heart feel especially safe and warm.
You know, just think about if you're a child and you're traumatized, and when we, in our field, when we think of traumatized children, I, of course, think about foster and adoptive children, but Marshall, you know that biological children can be traumatized, and it just doesn't take much in this world. And so that just, even as I'm sitting here with you, it just, that even calms my heart. I think that voice, what you just said, I would say, as I'm thinking back as a child, yes, I do, actually. And here's some things I'm thinking. And some children might say no, and they're just not ready to participate in that, and that's okay, but they feel good that they had that choice. But I think that probably many children would respond, don't you think? Is that what you're seeing in your practice? Many children do respond to that?
I think that kids are like adults, and they want to be understood first and foremost. And so when you let them be part of the experts on their own bodies, on their own minds, then it does feel respectful and reassuring, and plus the added benefit of helping us to actually understand them better. Mm-hmm. I think that especially in the world of trauma that you were just introducing, that there is nothing more important than sitting with a person that you believe truly is attempting to understand what you do, which is, I know, kind of Debbie's philosophy as well as her expertise in the area of trauma.
So, Debbie, tell us about that. What is, from your perspective, what does trauma specifically look like in a child? How does that differ from what it may look like in an adult?
Well, that's actually a better question for Marshall, since works with children. I specifically stay in the arena of working with adults, but I agree with what Marshall said earlier. You know, children are just smaller versions of adults, and we all have those same relational needs. And when we have experienced threat to ourselves or seen experience things that can be traumatic, and we can experience, we refer to that as all of us experience little T traumas, and we experience big T traumas. And of course, the big T traumas are going to be the things that are much more upsetting and much more threatening than some of the smaller ones. But to children, they really don't, you know, all they know is whether they feel, am I safe, am I secure, or am I, you know, am I being responded to, or are my needs being met? And so, you know, trauma is when we experience either threat to self or we see others experiencing threat, whether that has to do with physical or emotional, certainly with the children that we've been referring to as far as foster children. Many of them have had many threatening experiences or times of neglect, even emotional, you know, abuse comes in many forms. It can be physical, emotional, or sexual. So those children certainly have had a deficit in being responded to in the way you and Marshall have been talking about, you know, the things that are helpful with children. And that can actually set a child up. It can also set an adult up, not only to experience stress at that time, but even if that's not cared for in some of the ways that Marshall has been talking about this morning, then even down the line, that can come back up for a person and get triggered off and begin to influence the quality of their life and the quality of their relationships, whether they having to do with whether they feel they can trust the world or they can trust the adults in their world to be there for them.
So where you come in, it sounds like, is if a child has not had their needs met, and if they have not been able to enter adulthood with great safety and security and hope and probably excitement for their future, but are being held back and kind of stuck maybe in their trauma, and so then it sounds like that's maybe where you come in more. So when we come back from a break, we share with us, because I know you also specialize in post-traumatic stress syndrome, is that right?
Yes.
And so share with us what that looks like in an adult. And our hope for those of us working with children is that we can help them heal so they don't have your description of what it looks like in an adult. We want them to heal, to grow into their incredible destiny. But, you know, I know that there's going to be some adults listening that they themselves are maybe their friends did not receive their healing as children, and so we want to let them know that they're not alone, and we also want to give them some help, just like we were just giving children a few minutes ago, parents of children. And so we'll come right back. We're listening to Life Matters. Check us out and donate online, familylinkkids.com. Friend me on Facebook for updates, Mariah Wilde Family Link, and we'll be back in a minute.
Give me your eyes for just 1 second. Give me your eyes so I can see everything that I keep missing. Give me your love for humanity. Give me your arms for the brokenhearted, the ones that are far beyond my reach. Give me your heart for the ones forgotten. Give me your eyes so I can see.
Hi, welcome back to Life Matters. This is Mariah Wilde, and I'm here with two wonderful counselors, Marshall Lyle and Deborah Price. So we were just visiting about post-traumatic stress syndrome. Tell me, what does that look like in an adult?
All right. Well, first of all, there are many things, many types of stresses and traumas that occur that people manage to work through. They have support systems. They have their faith that helps them get through that. And so there are many traumas that can happen that, because we do receive the care that we need, because we do address, we face that trauma, we work through those emotions, we're able to grieve the hurt and the other emotions that go along with that and receive comfort, and so we actually are able to work through those. The next level would be where someone kind of experiences kind of an acute stress reaction, and that would be where for a short period of time, maybe for a month, they could experience recurring thoughts of what that event was, different things that would trigger off emotions about that, and yet they continue to process through. Post-traumatic stress is actually where someone can experience either close to the time of the event, after a month, continuing recurrent intrusive distressing thoughts about that event, where they can actually see images. They can have times where it affects their dreams. It affects sometimes they can actually even feel as if that event is recurring again, and so they can feel numbing in certain situations. So there can be physical reactions, there can be emotional reactions, but it continues to interfere with the quality of their life and the quality of their relationships. what can also happen is the emotional responses actually get varied, and then down the line, as we were talking about children experiencing trauma, those things kind of get buried, and then later in life, as they become a parent or they experience some of those key events in life, those memories can actually begin to come back. So God has created us in a way that even that ability to compartmentalize or kind of separate ourselves from those really frightening events, and that could even include some of the neglect and things that foster children experience. He's actually given us the ability to do that, to kind of get through, but then that can kind of come back up in the mind and the emotions later in life. So post-traumatic stress can happen, you know, within a few months of when something happens, or it can happen years from when the event happened. And it can be very upsetting, even as they remember things they literally have never, they've not been able to remember. It's not unusual at all for me to work with an adult who, when I ask them about their childhood, they'll say, I don't remember anything about my childhood, or I don't remember anything from this age to this age. And that's actually a way we are created to be able to cope with really overwhelming stress.
And so sometimes there are children that can't remember their past. And so we want to talk about them in a few minutes and how that affects, as PTSD can affect children. But if we have a listener right now who says, oh my gosh, I can relate, or my sister had something traumatic happen, and when she was talking, I was thinking of myself or my sister. What are some things that you can do? Of course, you know, they're welcome to come and visit you, but even during this time, we really want to give our listeners something that can really help them. So if somebody personally was relating to what you were saying, what do you have to offer them right now?
First of all, to be able to talk with someone about those memories that are coming up. And sometimes we can match to do that with a pastor. We can manage to do that with a friend, as that's what we call actually facing the memories and facing the traumas that are coming back up. But often it is very, very helpful to be able to do that with someone who is more specifically trained to help people to deal with those memories and those responses that are coming up. So counseling can be very, very helpful with that, and it also can be helpful particularly if a person does have a spouse or a family member that can participate in that with them. One of the things we can do is actually kind of help that person in more of a family kind of way, in terms of how can you come alongside and help give care to this. When we're really talking about what we would define diagnostically as post-traumatic stress, there are a number of counseling approaches that then develop that over time we are really seeing from the research that they're very effective with that. And so one of the things that can be very helpful with that, and is a fairly short-term type of therapy, is a therapy called EMDR therapy that's been around for about 25 years. And so often with children and adults, I do not use that with children, but there are very competent people in Austin who do. I specifically focus on work with adults and young adults, but EMDR therapy can be very helpful with helping get that desensitized.
And what does that entail?
Well, EMDR therapy is a type of therapy that when a person experiences trauma and that is very upsetting and often overwhelming, what happens is their brain, it becomes about the brain and the neurology of what's actually even happening in the nervous system. And so their brain literally gets overwhelmed. It cannot process all the information, all the experience that they are experiencing as it does ordinarily. And those events actually kind of become frozen in time. And where normally we're processing with all parts of the brain. Only the emotion, it kind of gets frozen in time in the emotional part of the brain. And so as those memories begin to come back up or remain, what happens is remembering the trauma may literally feel as bad as it did the first time that that person goes through the trauma. And so they can experience memories of the images, of sounds, of smells, of feelings, as if they haven't changed. And that's really what that post-traumatic stress is. People might be able to relate that to. We talk about people coming back from war experiences and having flashbacks and disturbances in not being able to sleep, physical symptoms and emotional symptoms. And so what's happened is the brain and the nervous system hasn't fully been able to process that experience. And they really have, those memories have a lasting negative effect that interfere with a person being able to do normal daily life. EMDR therapy seems to have a real direct effect on the processing in the brain and on the nervous system, on the way that information, those experiences are processed. And so through EMDR therapy, which is a type of therapy that actually helps all of the brain begin processing that experience again, the processing is resumed, and often after some of the EMDR sessions, what we see is a person no longer relive those images and those sounds and feelings as they did when the event actually occurred, and they definitely remember the experience that they've had, but they don't have the emotional disturbance come up that is creates so much interference in relationships and in their life. And EMDR therapy is it's not hypnosis. It's one of the things that we believe it is very similar to is when someone goes into the deep sleep that is called rapid eye movement sleep. Mm-hmm. The eyes move from left to right, and what's actually happening is the brain is in that deep sleep state. We're actually processing things that we have experienced, we've seen, and we've heard, and we're working on continuing to get things processed in the brain and the nervous system. And so through it was actually developed through simulating those eye movements, which is actually stimulating left side of the brain, right side of the brain, and helping kind of jumpstart the brain, focusing on whatever that event was, helping the brain to go ahead and begin processing that again. And then as the brain processes what has been frozen in time, that's when the result that we get is that we have the memory of the event, but the emotional disturbance mm-hmm. has now been able to process. And we actually, over the last 10 years, we can actually see on what they call SPECT scans of the brain, where we can actually see changes in the brain as we might scan that person's brain before an EMDR session and then scan it afterwards, and we can see where the parts, that emotional midbrain that has been so hyperactivated by this traumatic event, where that is actually calming now, and the brain is actually able to experience the perception of that event differently, because now we're not only able to use the logical thinking, decision-making part of our brain, but that emotional part of our brain where that's been hyperactivated by trauma has calmed, and therefore that's what we believe is kind of happening neurologically in someone's body when that gets processed. So that's just, EMDR is one of the ways that we have found is very, very effective. Even as we have so many world events, what's happening in Japan right now, the Oklahoma City bombing, those kind of things, we have teams of people that go in and use EMDR in those really critical, massive situations, you know, where we have just huge trauma. We found that if we can go in and we can work with people early on in that process, then they don't develop the post-traumatic stress that comes up years later. That we help them get the body and the brain processing that experience and get that calmed down, and so they're actually able to experience something like that and still be able to go on with their lives and not have that be something that is so life-changing that it hinders their ability to function and have relationships.
Wow, that's interesting. And so I hope you guys listening recognize how much hope there is. You know,
yeah.
We want to be gentle and kind with our family members, with our children, with those. We always should be, but especially those who've been traumatized. But you have to know that there's hope. There's incredible hope. And so I appreciate you sharing that with us. That's what you shared applies to children and adults. And when we come back from a break, I want to hear from Marshall. What does post-traumatic stress syndrome usually look like in children? And in addition to what Deborah shared with us, we want to find out from Marshall, what are some other ways, things that we can say, things that we can do with hurting children? So we'll be right back. You're listening to Life Matters. Check us out. Help us help more children and donate online. Also, you can contact us through FamilyLinkKids.com. Friend me on Facebook for updates, Mariah Wilde FamilyLink, and we'll be right back.
Give me your eyes for just one second. Give me your eyes so I can see everything that I keep missing. Give me your love for humanity. Give me your arms for the brokenhearted, the ones that are far beyond my reach. Give me your heart for the ones forgotten. Give me your eyes so I can see.
Welcome back to Life Matters. This is Mariah, Executive Director and founder of Family Link Foster Care and Adoption Agency. And so, Marshall, I really appreciate your professional, but also your personal experience as a foster parent and then also as an adoptive parent. And so I imagine that you have seen what we're about to share within your own household and also within your practice. So I find that probably at FamilyLink, one of the most common diagnoses for children is post-traumatic stress syndrome. And some of the situations that we receive children from, it just makes sense. You know, we have children that are left alone in hotels. We have a set of children I'm thinking of under age two, three little kids left alone for we don't know how long till a maid found them. And then we have another little girl and baby that was left alone in a park, in a secluded area of a park for a very long time until they were found. Then we have other children that have seen parents killed, parents in unbelievable domestic violence. We have some children whose parents and relatives have on purpose broken their bones, bashed their heads in. Now, if those things don't create post-traumatic stress syndrome, I don't know what does. These bless these little children's hearts, but then we don't. Sometimes then a family might take them in as a initially as a foster child, and they say, but I don't know why. I just don't know what's wrong with Jonathan. I don't know what's wrong with Christina. And I'm like, well, I know what's wrong. Hello. And so share with us how those experiences can really impact a child.
Absolutely. And even as you were just describing it, impact the whole family.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, just adding on to what Debbie was saying, is in that moment where the parents first experience a kid's traumatic stress are really important, because it could be triggering traumatic stress in that parent that they didn't know that they had buried. And
mm-hmm.
So inviting the parenting experience into your home, be it foster, adoptive, or biological, really could be causing you to need to go back and look at some things, which is why we're so blessed here to have, you know, competent therapists who don't just work with kids, but also ones that we can trust with adult and marital issues. But with kids and trauma, the thing to really remember is that trauma is not something that you can define objectively, because it's really about the subjective experience of each individual kid. And so while we can go with some things as given, natural disasters and wars, I mean, even abuse, we can really see how trauma would come from those things. There are any of a number of other experiences that might feel traumatic to a kid, because it does feel like the end of their world, or it feels like too big of a pain that they know how to deal with, such as parental divorce or bullying or even choking, a medical emergency or surgery. I've even had kids who have been humiliated, embarrassed, and that's been stored as a traumatic memory in their brain. And so really stepping back and broadening the way that we might see trauma in kids is the first necessary step. After that, really recognizing the symptoms of traumatic stress coming to the surface in a kid. And it looks like all of the things that Debbie mentioned, but some of the kid versions of those things might be a heightened startle response. They're very jumpy to touch or loud noises. That they might be throwing tantrums that are unexplainable and seem to always come on after, you know, they hear the sound of a train or something that feels benign to us or unexplainable. They might start to have some impaired memory and concentration, nightmares and night terrors, which are, you know, two totally different beasts. But even in my own kids, one of the things that I noticed are things that require a little more subtle approach is to catching their racing heartbeats, really noticing regression and developmental stages. It's not just, you know, defiance. It could be something in their mind taking a step back for protective reasons. Their sleep gets disturbed. Their eating and digestion could get disturbed. And they might even become preoccupied and worried about death.
Oh, okay. So go back a little bit, and you mentioned a few things. I don't think that people need to know what you mean. So describe what it would look like a little bit more in these children. Well, you mentioned something about defiance, about temper tantrums. What does that look like? And so, and what should we do? What if we do have a 10-year-old that's actually, the parents are going, I don't even know what happened. I just said that she couldn't have that toy, that she was going to have to share it with her sister. I mean, that's not a big deal, I don't think. And the next thing you know, she's in the room screaming and hitting the wall. What should a parent do at that point?
It is really a hard discernment to make, you know, trying to understand the motive of any particular behavior. And sometimes that tantrum is completely age-appropriate and developmental, and you have to parent it with discipline, as you would expect. There are other times that behavior might be trauma or fear-based, and there are often little clues kids will leave to let you know that's what's going on. I've noticed a lot in foster and adopt kids, there becomes this look in their eyes while they're screaming or saying no or trying to run away from you that almost looks like they're not recognizing you in that moment, or they're seeing you as a real threat. And it's that little moment of lost connection and that fearfulness, that concern that shows up in their eyes can really be the clue that this is a fear-based response. And they're needing something more than the typical discipline we've grown up knowing about.
And so we just have a couple minutes left, but then let's just use that example. We have a child who one parent might say, oh, they're just throwing a fit because they want their way. But no, really, something triggered them. And so they're maybe reliving past hurt experience, and they're traumatized at this very moment. But it looks like they're throwing a temper tantrum. What can a parent say and do right then?
I think it's really important to try and be with the kid in the fear. You know, a typical parent approach is time out. And I think we really have to be careful when a kid's behavior is coming from a trauma place. We don't want to abandon them in their fear.
And so
if the kid is needing to be in a timeout in a room, it's great for mom and dad to go and be with them in it. And they might just be sitting in front of the door or in the corner, making themselves small and safe, and even offering reassuring words, perhaps even in the midst of the tantrum or in the meltdown, just saying, I know that there's something in your heart. I feel so sad for how hard it is. I'm going to sit here. I'm going to be safe. I'll be ready when you are. And wait patiently. Patiently pursue is the phrase I like. To patiently pursue the kid in spite of their distancing or defiant behavior. Really being reassuring, making sure that you're not threatening them in any way, that you're not using that moment to add more discipline, and that you're just setting boundaries of you're to be safe to yourself and others. You're to be safe to things that belong to you. But I can handle your feelings right now. I can understand how scared you are.
Oh, that is awesome. I am so happy we're doing a series because there is so much more for us to talk about. But even in this moment with my, let's say, 20-something years of experience, I've learned some key things that are really important. I can't wait to share them with our families. And I can't wait to hear more from you. Thank you so much. Both of you are incredible. Thank you for the work that you do. They both are at the Center for Relational Care. And give us your website really quick.
Yeah.
The website address is www.relationalcare.org, and there is information on there about the services that we have available, groups that we have available. Marshall actually will be starting a group for adoptive moms coming up
awesome.
Soon, and so we would love for people to connect with us and see how we might be able to minister to them.
Oh, that's so wonderful, and I can vouch for you guys. This right there here has been amazing. So I know in person, unbelievable help and hope. Thank you guys for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow night. Check us out, familylinkkids.com.